Some people, when they hear Noam Chomsky speak or when they read his work, say they really don't understand where he's coming from. But in one sense, his political economic writings are very simple to understand. He strives to write about ways in which the full participation of everybody is denied, and strives for ways to have that full participation brought back to people. He strives for ways to encourage voice for everybody, people who have had their voices denied, sometimes in disastrous ways. And he's written and spoken about endlessly in trying to transform political, economic systems, structures that stand in the way of us enjoying our life together in a peaceful way. We're very happy to have him here today, and maybe we could welcome him with a great sense of gratitude for Noam Chomsky.
A little over 200 years ago, Tom Paine summarized his hopes for the American Revolution that he had helped to inspire. He used the natural rights idiom of his day, updated given a contemporary form in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights 50 years ago. Paine hoped that the American Revolution would come to be what he called the first popular counter-revolution in history. It would be popular because it would be the first one to defend the rights of the bulk of mankind, and it would be a counter-revolution because it would seek to recover rights that are indefeasible, hereditary, rooted in our nature, rights that had been lost to conquest and tyranny, which had dispossessed man of his rights. The counter-revolution, he hoped, would promise a new era to the human race. Well, I guess restorative justice could be usefully understood in similar terms, namely as seeking to restore the full range of inherent rights of which people have been dispossessed by constantly changing forms of conquest and tyranny. In that same year, 1792, the leading framer of the new constitutional order, James Madison, expressed his growing concern over the fate of the democratic experiment that was just beginning. It was beginning already to take the form of a developmental capitalist state along lines advocated by his associate and rival Alexander Hamilton. Madison warned in 1792 that if this continued, it would lead to a government substituting the motive of private interest over public duty. The private interest would furthermore become concentrated and consolidated, leading to a real domination of the few under an apparent liberty of the many. Madison deplored what he called the daring depravity of the times, as the stock jobbers become the tools and tyrants of government, bribed by its largesses, overawing it with their clamors and combinations. He foresaw that business would cast over society the shadow that we call politics, borrowing now the term of John Dewey, 150 years later, describing the outcome, the existing reality, not giving a kind of a worst-case scenario for the future. Well, it's kind of illuminating, I think, to view the last several centuries of history as a conflict between these tendencies, which were very clear at the outset. The great beast, as Alexander Hamilton called the people, the great beast has over time actually won many victories, restored, recovered lots of rights, instituted rights more firmly from Thomas Paine's point of view. There have also been periods of regression with a powerful assault on rights and on democracy, leading to a real domination of the few under the apparent liberty of the many. And we happen to be living in one of those periods of regression now, not the first, probably not the last. It's a period of dedicated and very self-conscious assault, an elite effort, which is clearly has been aimed for the last 30 years to reverse the democratizing and civilizing effects of the activism of the 1960s and subsequent years, and to drive the dreaded great beast back to its cage. And as always, the beast isn't retiring quietly. That confrontation, which goes back here for 200 years, but goes back in history far beyond, that confrontation took sharply new institutional forms about a century ago with the consolidation of private power in the course of the process that's usually called the corporatization of America. It led to quite a substantial increase in the power of the tools and tyrants of government and their ability to overawe it with their clamors, which were louder, and their combinations, which were greater, essentially to take over the government instead of merely casting a shadow, and also led to an increasing ability on their part to demand and to receive enormous largesses through a variety of means that includes wide range from, say, the free risk insurance that's granted by the IMF to investors, to the ability to socialize costs by relying on a dynamic state sector to create the basis for the profits of the future right now for what's called the new economy and planning now for the next one to come. World War II drove that lesson home. It taught the corporate managers who flocked to Washington to run the semi-command economy. It taught them that a state-directed economy could indeed flourish and get the United States out of a deep depression as it did and lead to huge industrial development. The most successful period of economic development in U.S. history by far was during those years. By then, it had also become clear to the very same corporate managers that that was not only a possible system but a necessary one. As they put it right after the Second World War, high-tech industry cannot survive in a competitive, unsubsidized, free enterprise economy, and the government is the only possible savior. That's Fortune and Business Week expressing a pretty broad consensus and foretelling the economic future of the next half century, 60 years. It was also understood pretty quickly how they could get the great beast to accept this arrangement. It was explained, namely, usual device. Terrify them and they'll accept anything. Truman's first Secretary of the Air Force, Stuart Symington, good liberal Democrat, incidentally, he explained that the word to talk is not subsidy. The word to talk is security. That way we can get our subsidies from the great beast hiding in fear. And that remains true. I mean, the enemies change. You know, for a long time, it was John F. Kennedy's monolithic and ruthless conspiracy, as he put it, bent on world conquest. Later it shifted to international terrorism or narco-guerrillas or rogue states or whatever may be convenient, and it's going to have to change tomorrow to justify current plans, the current bipartisan programs, which are extremely ominous and developing quickly. The programs of militarization of space, of extending, right now it's a U.S. monopoly, but ultimately it'll be extending the arms race into militarization of space with the goal, which is quite clearly expressed. There's no reason not for us not to know it. It was expressed clearly by Clinton's Space Command about a year ago, who explained that the, in a public document, that the goal is to dominate the space dimensions of military operations to protect U.S. interests and investments and U.S. commercial interests generally. They went on to compare this to navies in earlier centuries, and that's an apt comparison. Navies, in fact, were developed to protect global investments and commercial interests of Britain and later the United States, to some extent others, and also naval development, if you go back a century. Naval development provided a huge stimulus for the steel industry. That's how the great pacifist Andrew Carnegie constructed the first billion-dollar corporation, relying heavily on naval contracts. and others too. Navies were crucial in developing the most advanced technology of the age, the hardest technological problems of machine construction and electronics of a century ago had to do with placing huge naval guns on big ships that were moving around and aiming at a moving target. It turns out to be quite a tricky problem, and that was the cutting edge of technology and industrial development a century ago, pretty much the way space research is today. There's a good deal of similarity. That's expected. That's the way the post-Second World War system of public financing of private profit developed, and it is expected to continue in the future. Notice that this is not military industry, contrary to what people often say. It's misleading to call it a military-industrial complex. It's true that there's a military cover and occasionally spin-off to the military, but it's primarily a mode of sustaining the private profit economy, very much as Fortune and Business Week recognized 60 years ago. And in fact, as everyone recognizes, except the great beast who isn't supposed to understand this, and maybe the economics profession doesn't understand it, I'm not sure, but it's pretty clear, it should be clear to everyone else. All of this not only makes sense, but fits into a well-established historical pattern. Meanwhile, these same processes should allow the increasing power and concentration of the fools and tyrants who want to be able to administer markets through mergers, strategic alliances, outsourcing, in fact, a whole range of devices to ensure that the rich and the powerful don't have to face market discipline. The poor and the defenseless, on contrast, must be subjected to it. That, again, continues a historic pattern of several centuries, which has played a large role in determining the contours of the world that we live in right now. Well, about a century ago, going back to the corporatization era, as I'm sure you know, the rights of persons were extended to these newly consolidating corporate entities. Then later, the rights of persons were extended to their management. This was by radical judicial activism, for the most part, very little legislation. It was very sharply condemned by conservatives. It's a category of people who did exist a century ago. The name still exists, but not the category. Conservatives were deeply upset by this. They condemned it as a return to feudalism and a form of communism, not without reason. There's very little doubt that the founders of classical liberalism would have been appalled, as would, in fact, anyone who understood that rights inhere in persons of flesh and blood, not in totalitarian entities or the central committee of the totalitarian entities like the management of a corporation. The comparison to other forms of totalitarianism is not inexact. Even the intellectual roots are similar. The recent trade agreements, they go well beyond what happened a century ago. They confer on these totalitarian entities rights that go far beyond those of mere human beings. It's worth remembering that the proponents of the corporatization process, who were mostly progressives, incidentally, about a century ago, they understood exactly what was going on, and they agreed with the critics. I may have put it a little bit differently, but they basically agreed. For example, Woodrow Wilson, notable case, he observed that, in his words, most men will become servants of corporations, which run the business of the country and are rivals of government itself, and by now have become the masters of the universe, in the phrase of the international business press, Financial Times. They were describing the January meetings of the international corporate elite in Davos, Switzerland last January, with only a touch of irony. It's meant it pretty accurate. Woodrow Wilson regarded the outcome as, again, his words, a very different America from the old, no longer a scene of individual enterprise, opportunity, and achievement, rather a scene of taking orders, and for some, transmitting orders down below, depending on where you stand in the tyrannical system. Wilson and other progressives understood that it wasn't going to be easy to get the great beast to accept the new America that was being created for them. It was also understood that it wouldn't be possible to do this by force. even though measures of force were not abandoned. Wilson's Red Scare was an example, and U.S. labor history from its origins right up till very recently has been extremely unusual in the high level of violence that was used in comparison with other industrial societies. And even today, in fact, labor rights in the United States are very primitive compared with comparable societies, which is not a great surprise in a business-run society. Well, by the 20th century, however, it was pretty clear that force could no longer be relied upon effectively in the more free and democratic societies where too many rights had been won or recovered from Paine's point of view. So it was necessary and understood to be necessary to control beliefs and attitudes, to regiment the public mind and direct the population to frivolous pursuits like fashionable consumption driven by created wants. These are all quotes from business literature 80 years ago. It's necessary to impose what was called a philosophy of futility. So we should therefore regard it as a triumph of American democracy and not a failure when growing numbers of people regard themselves as powerless. There's regular studies of this in polls, and the level of powerlessness has increased to historic heights, in fact, right before the November election, well beyond the previous peak, over half the population, about 75% of the population before the election. This has nothing to do with Florida shenanigans. Before the election, about 75% felt that the election had nothing to do with them at all, just something going on with rich folk and the public relations industry and so on. And over half felt powerless. People who take the polls regard that as a flaw of American democracy, but I think they're missing the point. It should be regarded as a triumph. That's the way it was designed, and it's succeeding. The rulers are achieving the goals. That's not a failure. There are other means of social control. I mentioned the traditional one, inducing fear, or devils, criminals in the streets. But when you have a frightened and powerless population, they conjure up their own devils. And that's very striking in American society. It's striking to see the fears and paranoia that emerge from depths of powerlessness. Actually, I think Timothy McVeigh is an example of that. It's kind of striking that in the last election, there are traditional class party correlations, and they persisted, but they were very considerably outweighed by other factors, factors that are of little concern to those who cast the shadow called politics, and therefore factors that are allowed to appear and right in the focus of attention. So, for example, gun ownership and what's called religiosity very strongly outweighed traditional class party correlations or economic issues altogether. With regard to religiosity, technical term, I apologize for it, in that the U.S. is off the spectrum of industrial societies by standard measures of religious extremism, fundamentalism. The U.S. is just entirely off the spectrum. It's also true of a lot of other things. One of them, which is ominous, I think, has to do with and does reveal the at least partial success of the huge corporate offensive, of the propaganda offensive of the past 20 years. One of them has to do with tolerance of inequality. Here the U.S. is very different by now from other societies. There have been some extensive studies of this, not only tolerance of inequality, but belief that the government should do nothing about it, that it's not a public responsibility. Just were some major comparative studies of many societies, 30, 40 societies, and the United States stands alone in this. The only countries that come close are two client states, Israel and Taiwan, rather similar, and Canada not too far behind, but most other countries are quite different in this regard. Now, that's an interesting and important change. It's a very radical change from not very long ago. It's a very remarkable shift from the period of the mass popular movements, labor movements, farmer movements, others. It's also an enormous shift from the position that was taken for granted in the classical liberal origins of modern democracy. Adam Smith, for example, you may recall that his rather nuanced advocacy of markets was based on the principle, his belief, that under conditions of equality, of liberty, markets would lead to equality, which was he took to be an obvious desideratum. He didn't argue for it to the extent that it would lead to that result. Some version of markets would be acceptable, he thought. It's kind of interesting to see how this issue is dealt with in the ideological realm today. Not just it's in the realm of public attitudes. It's a very significant and I think very ominous shift in the United States, and an important victory for the corporate media propaganda system. In the ideological realm, it takes kind of another form, which is also sort of interesting and enlightening. There is an economic doctrine. According to economic doctrine, what's called globalization is supposed to lead to convergence of to a single market, meaning a single wage and price and income. Things are supposed to become. In fact, that's a technical measure of globalization, is the extent to which you get such convergence, move toward equality. And there are some theorems that prove it's supposed to happen under conditions that don't relate much to the real world. Actually, what's called globalization has had the opposite effect. It's led to continuing to increasing inequality among countries and, more strikingly, within countries. Furthermore, that's expected to continue. There's an interesting study that just came out a couple of months ago by the U.S. intelligence community, they brought in specialists from the academic world and the private sector. It's projections for what's likely to happen by the year 2015. And they give several scenarios. What they describe as the most optimistic scenario is that globalization will proceed on course, and here's the description. Its evolution will be rocky, marked by chronic financial volatility and a widening economic divide. Notice what that means. That means less convergence, less globalization in the technical sense of the term, but more globalization in the doctrinally approved sense, meaning concentration of wealth and power in a small sector of the masters of the universe. Financial volatility, which they also predict, means slower growth. Deterioration in growth, and in fact other standard macroeconomic measures, have all deteriorated during the so-called globalization period. And that's true of the United States through the 90s, and it's true worldwide. Few exceptions are the places that didn't follow the rules. There is a lot of talk. You've heard a huge amount of talk about the fairy tale economy, and even if you look hard enough, read that during the 1990s, the United States had the greatest economic boom in its history, in fact, in world history. It's Anthony Lewis on the left in the New York Times. It's not a total fairy tale. It's more or less true for a small sector of the population. There is a small sector that did make out like bandits, maybe the greatest economic boom in world history. And those happen to include the people who tell everybody else the wonderful news. But for the ones who are listening to the happy stories, for the large majority of the population, it's a totally different world. This period has indeed been unusual in American economic history, but for the opposite reason. I don't think there's another period of, say, 20 years or 10 years, which didn't have any severe economic disaster, so not like the 1930s depression, but any period of more or less level development in which the overwhelming majority of the population, for them, standard economic and social indicators either stagnated or declined. That is unusual, and that is, in fact, the mark of the globalization period in the United States and, to a large extent, worldwide. Furthermore, just even simple measures of growth of the economy, growth of productivity, growth of trade, and others have declined pretty sharply under globalization. But that doesn't matter. It's a success because it is succeeding in concentrating wealth and power, and crucially, it's succeeding in undermining the great beast. That's important, and I think that's what it's all about. It's part of the general counterattack against the democratizing tendencies of the last 30, 40 years. Well, let's go back to the last election. Polls show pretty clearly that what dominated the election, what showed up in such voting as took place, were what are called non-economic issues, insofar as issues were involved at all. Actually, they weren't involved very much. One of the reasons was that people couldn't figure out where the candidates stood on issues. Of those who could figure it out, in some cases, turned out they supported Gore by a large majority, though they didn't necessarily vote for him. But for the most part, people didn't vote on issues. And that's an understandable result, and in fact, the intended result, if you take a look at the huge propaganda campaign, big extravaganza that was associated with the elections, television ads and all that kind of stuff, it directed people away from issues towards what's called in the trade qualities. You're supposed to focus on people's qualities, not issues. Qualities mean, so it's, for example, a major effort to craft George Bush into some kind of an ordinary guy from West Texas, not an elite Easterner who went to prep schools in Yale. Gore had to, he's also supposed to kind of look off soulfully into the sunset, with a compassionate face that takes some training. Gore was trained to shed the characteristics of the kid you hated in fourth grade. Those were the major issues, and that was the major discussion, and that's what people were supposed to focus on. And it happened. Where issues did enter, and they did, like, say, gun control and so on, they had to be confined to things that are of no particular concern to the rulers, so they don't care. Those issues can arise. Crucially, if the rulers and the great beast differ on some issues, then they are rigorously excluded from the electoral arena. It's kind of dramatic to see how this happens. And there's a good reason for that. If such issues were allowed to enter the electoral arena, the whole arena of public debate, you might have a recurrence of what was called the crisis of democracy 30 years ago. That is, the effort by the beast to enter the public arena to put forth their own interests and concerns and try to do something about them. That's called a crisis of democracy, and we can't allow that to take place again. They have to leave those matters to the people who call themselves responsible men and who serve private power and have to operate in what the World Bank calls technocratic insulation, not bothered by the beast. That's the disease that caused such alarm 30 years ago, and it led to this large-scale counterattack on many different fronts to contain the great beast and to chip away at the rights that had been recovered, sometimes institutionalized. That's the driving force of the so-called neoliberal ideology of the last 25 years. It's recognized to have been economically harmful, but that's not important. Even by standard measures, let alone sophisticated ones. But it's been highly successful in reducing the threat of democracy in a number of ways. One of them is simply to transfer decisions into private hands. Then you don't have to worry about the beast, can't do anything about it. It's called privatization. If choices and decisions can be moved over into the hands of unaccountable private tyrannies, formal democracy is fine. It's not a problem at all. That's even good, it's a nice propaganda effect. The financial liberalization, which set off this process 25 years ago, that has been well understood always to be a method of undermining the options for democratic choice. It's the main reason why capital controls were instituted in the Bretton Woods agreements 50 years ago, dismantled 25 years ago. And the general shrinking of the public sector, which is a major thrust of social and economic policy worldwide, has the obvious effect of undermining opportunities for democracy, effect and purpose, surely. It is generally understood that on economic issues, on crucial economic issues, the ruler and the beast tend to be on opposite sides, often sharply. And therefore, these issues just do not arise in elections. And it's very revealing insight into the way the country functions, the political system functions, to see how rigorously this principle is maintained. So take a look at a couple of cases. If you look at public attitudes, which are very closely monitored in the United States, you know, business wants to know what public's thinking. It's the way you design propaganda. One of the lead issues for the public is the trade deficit. That ranks very high in public concerns, and it's easily understandable that translates directly into loss of threats to jobs, loss of job security, loss of job quality. People feel it right away. In contrast, the trade deficit is a great boon to corporations. They love it. The current issue of Foreign Affairs, you know, main establishment journal, has an article explaining that it's unwise to do something about the trade deficit. For example, the trade deficit with Mexico, where they describe it as formidable and growing. The reason is the following: slamming the door on Mexican imports means slamming the door on corporate America. Two-thirds of the U.S. imports from Mexico are internal to corporations. That means they're not trade. They're centrally managed interactions within private tyrannies and their affiliates, and that does create a huge deficit, but it's very beneficial to the producers and very harmful to the working people in the United States, so therefore the deficit's a good thing. You don't want to slam the door on it, or you'd be slamming the door on corporate profits. Of course, working people, this is called trade, but it's not trade any more than transfers of, from Illinois to Indiana and then returning to Selim. This is just centrally managed interactions that happened across a border. In fact, if you did a serious analysis of what is legitimately called trade traditionally, you might find, you'd be likely to find the trade between the U.S. and Mexico has actually declined since NAFTA, because the proportion of it that's centrally managed has very sharply increased. It's increased by about a third. Well, working people can look at the same phenomena, and they see the effects on their jobs. That's particularly true when they know, even if the press won't report it, that the threat of job transfer has been used as a very effective device for union busting. It happens to be illegal, but it's sanctioned by criminal state. That's been particularly true since the Reagan years, when the criminality was quite overt and indeed discussed pretty accurately in the business press. Well, perhaps these arrangements, even if they're harmful to workers here, are helpful for Mexicans. Well, unfortunately, that's not true either. Wages in Mexico have declined about 25% since NAFTA. That includes a drop in manufacturing wages. That continues a steady decline since around 1980, when the neoliberal reforms were instituted. Poverty levels have been going up fast. Right now, they're going up since NAFTA. They're increasing about twice as fast as population growth. Internally in Mexico, power's concentrating in a smaller sectors of consolidated big business, usually linked to the United States. Smaller businesses, like peasant agriculture, just can't compete with the surge of highly subsidized high-tech products, exports coming in from the United States. Well, how does Mexico deal with this? Well, they have a huge export, namely their population. They're exporting their population. A lot of them get killed on the way, but some of them make it. They're exporting it here to provide cheap labor under indescribable conditions to the United States. The consumption levels in the United States are being subsidized by the impoverishment of poor people, of working people, peasants in Mexico. I'm actually quoting from a recent study of the Woodrow Wilson Center on this. And this is all expected to get worse for Mexicans as the new government is shifting the tax burden even more to the poor. Taxes on food and medicine are expected to be the largest component of new revenues. That's a tax on the poor, of course. These plans have aroused considerable praise in the press here, hailing Mexico's new democracy. Well, I'd like to come back to the elections and kind of hold off in your minds for a minute the quite important issue of what was kept out of the political arena. I want to get back to that. Let me take a moment just to talk further about Mexico. It's kind of, what happened there in the last years provides some useful background and kind of a good complementation to an understanding of what's happening in the United States, and it's kind of a microcosm of what's going on around the world. In brief, the problem of repressing democracy and dismantling rights, that's not a problem confined to the United States. It's a global problem that has to be fought globally, a major part of globalization. If you take a look at the political situation in the last 20 years in Mexico, there was a dramatic event. The ruling dictatorship was overthrown in the last election, and that was quite an achievement of the Mexican people. Here it's attributed largely to NAFTA. It's one of the great successes of NAFTA. But take a closer look. What happened is actually quite different and interesting. What happened is that 20 years ago, Mexico fell into a very sharp economic crisis. A large part of the responsibility for that crisis lies in the hands of the IMF and the World Bank, who were exerting enormous pressure on Mexico to continue borrowing and on banks to continue lending. And they continued the borrowing-lending pressure right up to the moment of the crash. Within a couple of weeks of the crash, they were still publishing learned documents about how wonderful it was. They withdrew them quickly after the crash. It's standard. Then came a huge increase in interest rates in the United States, the Volcker repression of the late Carter, early Reagan years, which was the first stage in neoliberal policy here, the domestic policy. Well, right after the crisis, Mexico initiated under pressure what are called neoliberal reforms. And they led to a lot of popular resistance and activism. That's common. By 1988, the situation was becoming pretty serious. In fact, in 1988, the presidential election was apparently won by a party of the left. In fact, the dictatorship was maintained only with massive electoral fraud. Notice this is all long before NAFTA. And that aroused concern in the United States. In 1990, 2 years after the election, which was just barely saved for the right, 2 years after the election, there was a Latin American strategy development workshop in Washington, which considered all of this. They concluded that U.S. relations with this murderous and corrupt Mexican dictatorship were, in their words, extraordinarily positive. But they did see a problem. There was a cloud on the horizon. They were thinking of the 1988 election. Here, give it in their words, a democracy opening could test the special relationship by bringing into office a government more interested in challenging the United States on economic and nationalist grounds. And that's dangerous. So what do you do with that? That's unacceptable. It's been unacceptable for a long time. It's important to realize how little things change. Since 1945, U.S. policy towards Latin America altogether has been based on a document called the Economic Charter for the Americas. That was imposed on the hemisphere in February 1945 at a meeting called by the United States in Mexico. The charter, the U.S. imposed charter, called for an end to economic nationalism in all its forms. We now have State Department records revealing what they were thinking about. They were concerned, Washington was concerned, its goal was to cut off what it called the new nationalism taking root in Latin America, which embraces policies designed to bring about a broader distribution of wealth and to raise the standard of living of the masses. They were concerned that Latin Americans are convinced that the first beneficiaries of the development of a country's resources should be the people of that country. And that, of course, will never do. Those are our resources, as leading planner George Kennan put it. We got to protect them. The first beneficiaries of a country's resources have to be U.S. investors. That's the charter. And that's the way it's been ever since. The history of the U.S. and Latin America for the last 50 years has largely been one of beating down any threat of the new nationalism every time it arose. In the 1980s, it was arising in Mexico, and it couldn't be tolerated. Well, what was done? What was done was to employ a device which was openly described as an effort to lock Mexico into the conditions of the Charter of the Americas, lock Mexico into the reforms, so-called, by a trade agreement. That's NAFTA. It locks them into the reforms. We don't have to worry about the democracy opening and any challenge. And NAFTA, of course, is unbreakable for Mexico. It's an agreement that they can't break. The United States can break it any time it likes. For example, the Clinton administration broke it by a stroke of the pen to ban Mexican tomatoes at the request of Florida growers on the open grounds that American consumers, U.S. consumers, preferred the Mexican product, so therefore it had to be banned. The U.S. can do that. Mexico can't. Simple issue of power. At the time of NAFTA, there was no issue of tariffs, so it had almost nothing to do with free trade. Mexico already had the lowest tariffs among developing countries before NAFTA. But the investor rights provisions of the NAFTA agreement, they are important. They ensure that there won't be any threat of a democracy opening, and that being the case, formal democracy can now be tolerated, even applauded, while Mexico falls deeper into ruin, except for the more privileged sectors, the Mexican wealthy and their U.S. counterparts. They can rejoice in the fairy tale economy that they proclaim. Well, let's come back finally to the U.S. elections of November 2000. These U.S.-Mexico interactions, which are mislabeled trade, they were off the agenda for the usual reason. The tyrant and the great beast were on opposite sides. The same was true of a much more significant agenda item, namely the so-called free trade area of the Americas, which is a generalization of the an extension of the Economic Charter of 1945. That's of great concern to the population of the United States, or to be more precise, it would be of great concern to them if they'd ever heard about it, and therefore they must not hear about it. We know that the issues in it are of great concern, but not the agreement, because people don't know about that, so they can't be concerned about it. And that's an important, that's quite important. The FTAA did not come up in the elections. Nobody mentioned it. Just as similarly, no meaningful discussion of NAFTA was tolerated in 1992, right before the elections. It's an interesting story, which is still suppressed. But for the FTAA, clear enough. Take a look back. Notice nobody discussed it. FTAA had been under negotiation for several years by trade ministers who are representatives of corporations and by the corporations. The media have known all about it, but they also know that it's necessary to keep it quiet, keep a veil of silence over it, just as in the case of NAFTA or the Multilateral Agreement on Investments. And the reason is understood, actually explained pretty frankly in the business press. The Wall Street Journal, for example, pointed out that opponents of these agreements have what they called an ultimate weapon, namely the population, great beast again. Therefore, silence is mandatory. Can't let that weapon be unsheathed. Actually, the Journal made these comments when it was lamenting the failure of Fast Track. It was beaten back under popular pressure a couple of years ago, and it is now considered the highest priority, actually bipartisan priority. As it's pointed out, it's necessary for what's called trade enhancement. In fact, it's now been relabeled as a trade enhancement initiative. And it's in a sense correct. The issue is whether trade agreements, so-called trade agreements, which remember have very little to do with trade, whether trade agreements, investor rights agreements, should be handled democratically or whether they should be handled in the Stalinist style. That is, the Kremlin makes a decision and the Duma says yes. That's the choice. And there's an overwhelming consensus, close to unanimity, that it has to be done Stalinist style. That's Fast Track. And there's a simple reason for that. If there is any opening to the public, the ultimate weapon will come out again. You'll never be able to ram it through. The issue has nothing to do with trade. It has to do with democracy. I mean, the most passionate advocate of free trade would be opposed to these arrangements, the Stalinist style arrangements called fast track if they happen to think that democracy was a good idea. Since they don't, they're unanimously in favor of the Stalinist style. The issue does have to do with free trade and a so-called trade in a special sense. That's the only way to ram through the investor rights agreements, and it's understood. So therefore, fast track is necessary, and we also are enjoined to keep to the newspeak terminology of free trade and trade enhancement. Notice that these issues about the FTA did break through to the world, at least, excluding the United States, at the Porto Alegre World Social Forum in January. That was kept out of the U.S. press, but known elsewhere. And it broke through to the general public in the United States as well in April at the Quebec Summit of the Americas. That's thanks to the tens of thousands of activists there who were very harshly condemned, and rightly, because they were departing from good form. They were enabling the great beast to find out something about what's happening to them, and that's not allowed. There was enough turmoil in the summit at Quebec that the masters had to do something about it, and they did. They issued a very stirring call for democracy and transparency, and that received a big press, front page stories about this great event. And commentators were greatly impressed, and in a sense, rightly. The declaration was at least as impressive as Stalin's constitution, which was taken about as seriously by the commissars as this is taken by our guys, namely very seriously, because on both sides they do take it seriously as ingrained support for power. No hypocrisy. If you want to know how seriously other people should take it, just have a look at what happened. The proceedings of the meetings were secret. The text that's being discussed is kept secret. That's in the interests of what's called transparency. Ultimately, it'll be stuck on the web somewhere. And that means that, in principle, everybody in the country knows about it, like the way you know about some other arcane matter, if you know how to look. The corporate lawyers who wrote it, of course, they know all about it. So that's transparency. Actually, the meetings were discussed honestly in, as far as I can see, one newspaper, the major business newspaper in the world, the London Financial Times. They even had a report on the one opening that was made to what's called civil society, the leaders that they did, in the interest of democracy, allow civil society to enter the discussion. And there was a sardonic report of it in the Financial Times. They had a side session in which people, well-dressed academics with ties and jackets, were allowed to come in and make three-minute presentations and then sit down. But the reporter said, well, we can't tell you what they said because the press was kicked out of the meeting in the interest of transparency. So that was a democracy. There was a huge publicity for President Bush's major speech in which he talked about the wonders of NAFTA and how this should be a model for the FTAA. Well, what are the wonders of NAFTA? There were two major publications on this that were timed for release for the summit, both by organizations that are not particularly obscure. One was Human Rights Watch, the main international human rights monitor. The other was the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, which is a standard economic analysis institute. The Human Rights Watch report was on labor rights under NAFTA, and it concluded that they have deteriorated significantly, primarily because the three governments, crucially the U.S. government, were trying not only adhering to the wording, but trying to undermine it. So that's the first report. The second report by the Economic Policy Institute was a close analysis of the effects of NAFTA in all three countries, and showing that in all three countries, for working people, that means the large majority, the results were harmful. It's pretty hard to find an agreement which is harmful for everybody concerned, except, of course, the wealthy sectors who not only did enrich themselves, but also succeeded in the larger purpose of undermining democratic and developments and rights. Well, those two major reports were on every news desk. They were released for the summit. And they were reported. They were reported in the Financial Times. And to be honest, there was actually an op-ed in one local newspaper in the United States. These consequences are pretty much as were predicted. They were predicted by Congress's own research agency, the Office of Technology Assessment, in 1992, when they did an analysis of NAFTA, and the executive version predicted that it was going to have these effects and offered an alternative. They were also predicted by the labor movement, which came out with a long study at the same time of about the same sort. Neither of these studies were ever allowed into the discussion. In fact, they've never been mentioned to this day in 1992, again, in the interests of democracy and transparency. The central issue at Quebec and the FTAA is what's called the Agreement on Trade and Services. The word trade is put in there to sort of sneak it into these agreements that have anything to do with trade. Services is a name that refers to any, just about anything that might be in the public arena. So education, health, environmental issues, resource control, energy, any of that stuff. That's all services, things that governments do, that people are supposed to have some say in a democratic society. And that has to be eliminated. You have to transfer that to the private arena, to private hands. And there are various devices for doing this, interesting ones. If that can be done, then the hemisphere can be locked into a very harsh version of the Charter of the Americas, now much more explicit and detailed than it was 55 years ago. And if that can be done, and that's the goal, then you can really allow the great beast back into the public arena, because there won't be anything to do. It'll be essentially closed. It'll be in the hands of unaccountable private power, and therefore democracy can flourish without any crises. Well, it's easy enough to continue with all of this. A lot of more examples if you want more, but there's enough. The developments are not at all surprising. They are exactly what you should expect. They're not even novel. The modalities, of course, are always changing, but the general thrust is always the same. And as in the past, they are not likely to be successful. They haven't been successful in the past. They won't be now. There is a cycle, clear cycle of progress and regression. Over time, the cycle is generally upward as rights are recovered and established and instituted, and there's no reason to expect this to change. If it does come to an end, that's the end of human civilization, and there's surely no reason to let that happen, sit back quietly and watch it.